are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Kendra Holt Moore, and my favorite trivial fact is that as a unicorn collector, I know that people used to believe in the healing power of unicorn horns, and so people used to sell narwhal horns as unicorn horns to trick people into buying them and using them in their medicine.
My name is Ian Benz, Associate Professor of Elementary Science Education at UNC Charlotte, and I can't guarantee this is my favorite ever trivia fact, but it's one that popped in my mind that I really love, that the main reason why Luke Skywalker's lightsaber in Return of the Jedi was green was because of filming purposes with special effects. And that's what made it so that it was green instead of blue. I think it was easier to do it that way.
Rachel Jackson, Rabbi at Agudas Israel in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And my fun fact is that there are over 400 billion Lego pieces that have ever been created. And because they're so sturdy, unless someone actually threw them away, they're still probably being used to construct awesome things.
I'm Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania, and this fun fact comes to you from the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, which is all about fun facts. The Asphodelia maggot can jump 30 times the length of its own body, but only in August.
Oh.
That's weird and disgusting.
That is
and specific.
Okay, so it begs the question, how long is its body?
Small.
That's not part of this fun fact.
It is a tenth of an inch. It curls itself up like a little Cheeto and then, bang.
Okay, so it can junk about 3 inches.
You know what? When you say it like that, it's nearly 5 inches. So whatever. We have a super special guest today that we are very excited to talk to. Our guest today is the founding director of Sinai and Synapses, which is the organization that brought us together. His work has been supported by the John Templeton Foundation, Emmanuel J. Friedman Philanthropies, and the Lucius N. Litauer Foundation. And his writings about the intersections of religion and science have been published in the books 7 Days, Many Voices, A Life of Meaning, as well as the Huffington Post, Nautilus, Orbiter, Science and Religion Today, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and My Jewish Learning. He was an adjunct professor at both Hebrew Union College, a Jewish Institute of Religion, and the Academy for Jewish Religion, and is an internationally sought-out teacher, presenter, and all-around wonderful guy. This is Rabbi Jeff Middleman. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Zach and everybody. Nice to talk with you all here. I'm happy to share one of mine, which is that, fun fact, we live closer to Tyrannosaurus Rex than Tyrannosaurus Rex lives to the Stegosaurus.
That is kind of fun.
I literally used that in my Rosh Hashanah sermon.
Yes, you did. It is so wonderful to have you on this podcast. We have been talking about having you on since before we started. So it only took us 11 episodes to have you on.
Well, this has just been one of the greatest outgrowths of Sinai and Synapses, of seeing the work that the five of you are doing. You're five of my favorite people. All the fellows are some of my favorite people. But it is absolutely just, it warms my heart to listen to you each week. And the things that you're exploring and talking about are exactly the things that we're trying to explore as well.
I should also say that Jeff is the most encouraging and nicest person I've ever met.
That is true.
Hands down.
Yeah.
At one point, Jeff said that he appreciates my endless energy and enthusiasm, and that has been an inside joke between me and my wife ever since, because I'm glad that I put that out, and that Jeff sees the best in people, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
I don't feel that about myself, but Jeff sees that in me, and so I want to live into that.
Yeah.
I want to be the person that Jeff and my dogs think that I am.
That could not be a higher compliment to Jeff than to be associated with,
oh, that's
with my wonderful dog. It's Claire's birthday today, by the way. So pet your
Happy
dog.
Birthday.
Happy Aww. Birthday.
She doesn't or listen woof, to the woof. Podcast. She's Yeah, she's not really into science. But anyway, we have Jeff on the show today to talk about a couple of things, but mostly to talk about the work that's going on with Sinai and the Synapses. We've mentioned this fellowship before, this program before. It's on the website. We've mentioned that this is where we met each other and where this work started, but we haven't really taken any time to talk more in depth about what it is. And so, Jeff, we thought that you could speak much more to this than we could. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how it got started, what's the spirit behind it, what's been the work, what is it that gets you excited about this?
Sure, thank you. And it's really easy to be encouraging and see the best in all of you because you all are unbelievable people. And
see, there it is right there.
Thank you, Jeff.
So
we need to make sure that's shared with everybody.
That's right. So Sinai and Synapses started in 2013. Now, sort of in retrospect, just to realizing why I started it then, is we are living in this world today where we are living in a polarized society in a variety of different ways we're polarized. But right now, it is very much one side is viewed as scientific and educated and liberal, and the other side is viewed as uneducated and religious and conservative. And there's a belief that if you buy anything in either of those columns, you've got to buy everything in that column. And it's even better if you demonize the other side. And that's certainly happening now, but it's not actually that new. It's been going on for a long time, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. I think it's worse now than it had been. And we really felt like, you know what, we need to be able to elevate the public discourse, be able to think about some of these kinds of questions and to be able to say, wait a second, there are people, I think there are people who have elements of both of those pieces. If they're scientific, they also may be religious. They may be scientific and hold slightly conservative views. They may be liberal and very religious. And so how can we at least give them a voice? Because conflict sells. That's what gets clickbait. That's what gets eyeballs on websites. That's what sells advertising to be able to get TV. How can we have a deeper, richer conversation? And so in 2013, I started with this idea. I actually started thinking about the idea in 2011 and wondered, is anybody going to be interested in this? Is anybody going to want to talk about these kinds of questions? And so I started by calling basically 12 of my friends and said, I've got this weird, wacky idea. What do you think of coming together? Let's do, I don't know, three times a year, from people from all different backgrounds, professional backgrounds, geographic backgrounds. Let's come together and let's talk about some of the big issues that we're grappling with because we're struggling with so many huge questions in our society today. We need wisdom from as many sources as we can get. What would happen if we get some really smart people in the room? Let's have them learn from some experts and see what happens. Let's, you know, create some content. Let's create some blog posts and podcasts and videos. And let's see, is anybody going to be interested? And the answer seemed to be yes. You know, these 12 people who are we then called it the Sinai and Synapses Fellowship. What really struck me was the relationships that got built. Because what we're discovering, and we've seen this in a lot of ways, is that even the people who really do want to elevate the public discourse and embrace a lot of this both and mentality, they're very siloed. Academics tend to be very, very focused on their work and their very narrow element. Clergy are spending all of their time doing clergy work, acting pastorally, writing sermons, and they don't get a whole lot of intellectual reinvigoration. And the connections and relationships got built, and we said, there's really something here. So in 2015, we decided, let's open this up as a competitive application process. We were hoping we'd get 12 more, and we ended up getting, I believe it was 43, and we were shocked. And so we selected another 12, and then in 2017, we got some funding from support that was secured by the Issachar Fund, to be able to expand it a little bit. And we went from 43 to 62 applicants. And all of the five of you here were part of that group in 2017, able to expand it to 16 fellows. And it's now just, it's growing and growing and growing and growing. We actually just opened up a next round of applications and happy to talk about that too as well. But we really have discovered that when you bring smart, kind, thoughtful people together who are interested in learning and interested in contributing, you know, not just taking, but also giving, amazing things can happen. And we don't quite know what the outgrowth, we didn't know what the outgrowth was going to be. Down the Wormhole has been, I think, one of, if not the most successful outgrowths of this fellowship here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Stunned silence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this podcast started because of all of the breakout sessions where we were recording content for Sinai and Synapses, some of which will be released in the near future, probably. I mean, some of it has been released in the past. And those sorts of conversations where we just sat four or five people around a group of microphones and had a conversation in which one person kind of knew something about it and the rest of us talked about it, those were so invigorating. And I can say, I personally relate to this, to what you just said, that clergy are often trying to do their clergy work and we're just putting out fires all the time and we don't have this time to see new ideas and be reinvigorated. And I would always come back from our meetings and just so full of ideas and energy and enthusiasm. And I would bring that to my congregation and would be preaching these sermons. And I've been putting together workshops for other churches. And I just, having that kind of exposure to those people has been such a spark to my own creativity that I know for a fact would not have been otherwise.
Thank you. You know, and we tried very, and we try each time to be very intentional about everything that happens in the fellowship. So we structured the questions to be the ways to try to get the answers that we're looking for. When we interviewed everybody, we said to everyone, we're looking for people who are curious about a lot of different topics, because there are some people who are going to say, I am passionate about combating climate change. Like, great. You've also got to be curious about astrophysics, right? You've also got to be curious about technology. You've got to be curious about the world in general, but you've also got to be curious about other people. And the other piece too is that people have to be kind, because very often in an academic setting, and sometimes in a religious setting too, there's a little bit of one-upsmanship. And we want people to be able to say, that's a really interesting point. Can you expand that a little bit? I think, you know, a lot of our goal is to create a safe enough space to be able to go to some of the more dangerous elements. And so we were very, very intentional, and we will be in this next round as well, of selecting the not only the best individual fellows, but also the right dynamic, because we wanted to have a mix of men and women. We wanted to have a good mix of religious backgrounds, professional backgrounds, geographic backgrounds. And then, I know you all kind of joked about this a little bit, but we really felt strongly that the first year, you had never met each other before the first year. We created a structure where you're going to get to know the fellows to as deeply as you can in a short period of time. And so we structured the breakout meetings and the breakout groups so that over that first year, you would all get to know each other a little bit. And we also made sure that that when we sat around the conference room, because there's 16 people, that you were not going to sit next to somebody that you were going to be with in the afternoon, because who do you talk to at lunch? You talk to the person next to you. So we wanted to really try to structure ways to make sure that you can at least get to know the people around you. And then beyond that, whatever the relationship happens, it happens. And you're going to click with some and you may not click with others, but that's fine. You know, there's 16 people there. And then when we had our alumni meeting, we had previous fellows there. It was amazing to see. I was nervous. I think everyone was a little nervous of, wait a second, this is three different groups. They haven't met each other. And it felt just like instantaneous. And it's just wonderful seeing people from the 2013 group sharing something on Facebook about their personal life and somebody from this group saying, oh, what a wonderful, you know, congratulations on this or that, or here's a thought that you've had. You know, I think that it helps create a more expansive kind of conversation. And we really felt like, let's get the right people in the room doing the right kinds of things and then just wind you up and watch you go.
So how much of that do you actually plan? Like, like you said you plan for where you're sitting and what the topics are and all of that. But in terms of output, creative output, or intended goals, how much of that do you actually plan, and how much of that is just, you know, let it all fall where it may?
We're very much a believer that good process leads to good results. And there are going to be very few bad results, right? Like if their output is delivering an incredible sermon or a new adult ed class, that's fantastic. If it's writing an article for a blog on another website, that's fantastic. If it's a collaboration that comes out 4 years down the road of a peer-reviewed paper, that's terrific as well. Because each one of the challenges is that each of the fellows are doing their own work in their own field. So, you know, Rachel, you are not necessarily going to be trying to create a peer-reviewed paper, right? That's not your goal. But you know, somebody like Kendra, you're trying to make sure that you've got some publications to be able to do that. And you're not going to be, it's not as high a priority for you to make sure that you give a sermon at some point. You know, that's not where your goal is. But what we really feel like, let's get content. We need to get content out because we've got a few thousand people who read us each week, and sometimes more depending on the indirect pieces. So we need to have some content for the website and for the wider world as much as we can. But we also want to make sure that the fellows are getting what they need in their own work. And, you know, one of my favorite pieces of this was there's two of our fellows from 2015, Rabbi Ariel Hanin and David Bosworth. David is a professor of Old Testament at the Catholic University. And Ariel is a rabbi in Los Angeles, who works on combating trauma. And David is in DC. He's in, I think, in rural Maryland. And they clicked so deeply talking about questions of trauma that when David wrote a book about, I think it was Weeping in Akkadian Literature. I have to look at, he has another one that I can't even remember. Like, you know, the most niche thing that you could have, he thanked Ariel and the Sinai and Synapses Fellowship, right? So this rabbi who, Ariel's not necessarily trying to do peer-reviewed work, but mm-hmm. that helped David in his work, and Ariel, when she's trying to be able to work on trauma, is able to rely on some of the work of the other fellows to be able to help her in her practice. So we really felt like, let's get the right people, and we have very, very tight reins on who we're selecting and what's going to happen leading up to the room, and try and moderate the room. That's a little bit of a challenge also, but then having very loose reins beyond that.
I just have to say that the first time this group walked into the Sinai and Synapses room, which was housed in the Klall Library in New York, and there's this square table and all these nameplates, and you're looking around going, well, who is this person? Who is this person? And I sat down next to this person. So I think I've expressed here, I got my degree in chemistry. And did that for about 10 years and then changed over to the rabbinate. And I sit down next to a person who has a degree in chemistry and is also looking at the ministry. I was like, this was intentional. This was good. I don't know how to, I don't know the word right now, but like manipulation at its finest. And it was awesome. And I think that intentionality does lead to good conversation, right? Because there's at least that thread of something. And at each step of the way, there is a thread of connection. And it's like, okay, so I feel a level of comfort, which to me has added, you know, after the end of this fellowship, just that comfort of knowing there is someone that I could talk to about something if I needed to. So, right? Our opening trivia question, our opening question was about trivia, and Jeff shared one about dinosaurs, which also happens to be one of my favorite trivia things, so much so that I had the confidence to explain that in my latest Rosh Hashanah sermon. And I wouldn't have done that a couple of years ago, explaining the different extinction periods of dinosaurs on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. So I think in that way, what comes out of it is much more about the relationships in addition to the product, because the relationships change the product.
Hmm. I remember the first day of Sinai and Synapses when I said something about, well, you know, in the Bible, it says this, and Rachel interrupted me and said, and whose Bible is that? Whose Bible are you talking about? And I was like, who is this person?
I totally did it. I totally did all that snark too.
And you could have absolutely just said, well, my Bible.
And I was like, oh, thank God, there's somebody here who has the courage to just call me out when I have blind spots. Oh, this is wonderful. And she has been calling me out ever since.
And a large part of that is that it's important to be able to have a safe enough space to be able to challenge, right? Like, that could have gone really badly really quickly. And knowing that when people walk in for the first time, there's not, I remember there was a thing that I went to, I don't know, when I was first in rabbinical school, and everyone sat for the first time and said, I want you to know it's a safe space right now. I'm like, it's not, not a safe space just by saying that. I don't want it to be like a safe space of an anodyne kumbaya moment, but you need to be able to have some safety in knowing that you can say something kind of snarky or challenge or a little sarcasm and know that it's going to be received in the way it's intended. And so some of that is, you know, we try to really make sure that it's personal, but giving people enough opportunity to think about, okay, how vulnerable do I really want to be? And what's, it's always amazing to me is that usually by about the second or third meeting, there's a level of vulnerability where people are often crying. And, you know, these are people who have spent a total of 15 hours together in their life and are able to open up in a way that some people said they've never felt that safe to be able to open up in this way.
I really like how, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, the efforts and lengths that you went to establish a safe space, a place where we can be vulnerable. I think that the first year of relationship building was vital. You know, it made it possible to where that, you know, I could easily share that these are the things I am personally working on that I personally struggle with, and know that, you know, which is a very high level of vulnerability, especially for myself. And so it was very comforting to know that when I would ask questions that I have, that it wasn't a, who is this guy, you know, challenging my views on something, he's evil, blah, blah, blah. It was he's genuinely curious. Mm-hmm. And that's what I loved the most about it. And that it also gave, you know, especially with my position as a science educator, you know, in academia, I don't get a lot of opportunity to talk about science and religion as much as I'd like. And so, you know, I remember telling people from the very beginning that it was just so much fun for me to go to these meetings because I had that opportunity to talk about something I'm so passionate about and think of it in different ways that I've never thought of it before. And then the confidence too, that I think it gives all of us, you know, I would have never expected to be a co-host on a podcast that we're trying to grow. I would have never expected to write a book about my journey through science and religion ever. And so the courage, I think, and confidence it's given me has just been, you know, you can't, there's nothing else like it.
One of the most gratifying, there have been a couple lines that have been extremely gratifying. One was an academic, I don't even remember who, but said, this is what I thought and hoped academia was going to be like. And so that's, but after the alumni meeting, we had, I don't know, 25 or 30 former fellows. We asked them, reflecting on their time, and it was all three fellows, how much of this fellowship impact you personally, how much of this impact you professionally? And was it, you know, not at all, a little bit, somewhat, or a lot? and you know, you can bucket the somewhat or a lot. You know, so there was some pieces. 100% said it impacted them personally, which is wonderful. But 92% of them said it impacted them professionally, which is incredible considering how many different professions were going on with professors and rabbis and Episcopal priests and UCC ministers and doctoral students. And to have, you know, this group that's coming together, because so much of the work that everyone does is so narrowly focused generally that actually the broader conversation helped them be better in their narrow work. So, you know, there's an area of like, you come in narrow or you come in specialized, you're going to broaden because I think it's interesting and it's fun. And then you can narrow again because very often, and this is very much the hope, and this is actually very much modeled after a program that Klall ran called Rabbis Without Borders. But it's a lot of the goal is people remember what they hear, but they definitely remember even more what they say. And so a lot of the role of the small groups and the large group conversations is facilitating everyone to be able to share something that they're thinking about and go, wait a second, when you quoted that New Testament verse, that I didn't even realize that, but now I'm thinking about my research on awe that I'm working on that I hadn't even thought about. Or, you know, I'm talking about the role of technology and religion, and this is now changing the way that the sermon I'm going to give on Sunday. I hadn't even thought of that. And so being able to come in many ways through the side door, it creates an opportunity for everyone to be better at their own work.
Absolutely.
So without having kind of clear quantifiable outcomes for these fellowship programs, does that make it difficult for you to get funding? Because I know that if people are going to pour money into something, they're going to want to have good results. But to say to an organization, hey, we want to do this thing that literally no one in the world is doing, and our outcomes are going to be vague and nonspecific and probably amazing, but I can't tell you, maybe they will. How does that conversation go?
So I've been very blessed with a couple of different places on this. It is challenging to find funding. There are some deliverables, right? We've got to have content. Like I'm very proud that we basically have a new piece of content from Sinai and Synapses every week from a few of our projects or from multiple different projects. So we've got to have content. We've got to, you know, one of the questions is how many people are reading it? You know, what's the click through rate? That's, you know, we've got that number. How many people are applying for the fellowship? How interested are people in this? You know, those are the different pieces, but also trusting that all the fellows are going to be creating things. And by the way, some of the fellows we create, and some of the fellows that we select, we know are going to have a gigantic output, right? You know, they're going to get a couple hundred thousand people reading their blog, and right, like that's, and so we know that their work is going to be out there, and then we can associate with them, and that's fantastic, and that's...
Oh, that would be awesome. Can you help me do that?
Well, some of it's a built-in mechanism, right? Like that's, right? Like, so there are a couple of people who are already blogging for places.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we can say a former Sinai and Synapses fellow wrote this piece and, you know, that reaches however many people it reaches. So there are some metrics on that. I was very, 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 very blessed that when I was first thinking about this idea in 2013, I found not one, not two, but three major, major donors. And then a handful of pretty decent sized donors that I had relationships with and had means, had connections with either me or with Klall, and basically said, we're going to overgive. We're going to give you a lot of money at the beginning. I'm going to dial way back 3 or 4 years later, but I don't want you doing a half-assed job. I don't want this to be a mediocre thing. I think there's some real potential here, but I know that you're going to need some resources to be able to do this. So for about the first 2 or 3 or 4 years, it was from predominantly individual donors. And then since then, I've developed some relationships with some donors. The Issachar Fund has been an incredible godsend for the fellowship. And then And then the John Templeton Foundation, which funds a lot of our other projects, that's able to fund a couple of our projects right now, which means that a lot of the teaching that I do, I go around, I teach in a lot of places, that also brings in some money to be able to support the fellowship as well. So it is definitely a challenge because it is an academic, or I don't want to say it's academic, it's an intellectual element, and it's not necessarily direct service piece, right? Like, so we're not feeding the hungry, we're not helping the homeless. I think those are incredible organizations, and I think that we need to be able to do that. We're trying to be a couple levels up to be able to reach that farther down. So it's harder to find, it's hard to find foundations that are going to support this. It's hard to find individuals, but this is, in my mind, this is such crucial work because it's redounding in so many different ways, right? So if it's 40, 50 fellows, that's not necessarily, okay, the 14 or 15 fellows. It's now ultimately, if we can do 4 or 5 more rounds of the fellows, if we've got 100 people who are able to think and talk about these kinds of questions, it's not additive, it's multiplicative.
Well, I would think too, I think the question, Zach, you asked about funding is key because, it's smart then that that there are some fellows who are already connected and have, an audience already within either media or some sort of, either social media or blogging or as a reporter or in something like that, a writer. And then you have those of us who are not connected that way, but have the desire to get connected, that it seems like, the hope there is that you see promise in those individuals mm-hmm. who don't have that larger footprint mm-hmm. yet when it comes to media and, outreach mm-hmm. and that it's a long-term investment type mm-hmm. deal.
Yep.
Right. I mean, I can speak for myself as an academic. Academics, we typically don't have, the overwhelming majority, I would think of academics don't have a huge footprint in the general public.
Right.
And I know I've said to others, and my academic friends may hate me for this, but there are definitely times where I am so tired of writing journal articles for academics that are barely read because it's kind of a, what good is it doing if it's not helping the teachers and the people who are struggling with these mm-hmm. issues, right? Or have questions and need help. So and one thing I love about this.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kendra.
Yeah, you go ahead, Kendra. You haven't said anything, and I'll jump back in.
Yeah, I'm having some technological difficulties over here, so I missed a chunk in the middle, and since I've been back, there's been a few freezing episodes. So I would like to just kind of put out there what I want to say in case I get cut off completely.
go ahead.
But yeah, I agree with what Ian is saying, and that going back to earlier reflections that you all shared about, like the first day that you walked into the first meeting, I know for me, it was really encouraging to just break out into a different format. And I think that even if you are a creative person, and even if you have a really creative career, it's still really easy to get into a routine and a rhythm of seeing the same people every day. You have a schedule that you have to abide by. And regardless of whether or not that's something that feels mundane or is very creative, like you can still fall into a rut. And so as an academic, I feel that the day-to-day of my own schedule is one where I'm supposed to be creative and be producing information and stuff like that. But I still get in those ruts where I'm not asking questions that maybe this group of people would ask outside of the institution. And I felt that when I met all of the Sinai and Synapses fellows, I just was opened up to the opportunities of what I could do, but had not previously thought I could do. And I think the best example of that is the first time that I was asked to be part of a podcast, interview session where Zach led. I thought to myself, oh no. I was a little bit...
I have that effect on people.
And not because of Zach, because he did a great job. But in that moment, I was just like, this isn't what I was made to do. Like, what? I'm going to be terrible at this. I don't know what to say. I don't... So I had all these concerns, not about the people or the conversation, but I just was thinking, like, this is... I care about public outreach, and I don't, like Ian was just saying, I don't want to be stuck in the ivory tower, but it was new and I had never done that before. And I just didn't know, like, how did the logistics of making a conversation like this work? And so I did it and then was asked to do another one and another meeting and had like some reservations, but was like a little bit more willing. And then over time, it just made me feel like, yeah, these are people, creative people who are different, doing different things than what I'm doing. And when we come together, it breaks us all out of the ruts that we all find ourselves in. And you have these new, interesting projects that I think really contribute to the goals that Sinai and Synapses like wants to accomplish. And I think that's a really beautiful thing and is so crucial for actually engaging public dialogue, or actually enhancing and furthering public dialogue. So yeah, that's definitely how I have felt enriched by Sinai and Synapses. And I also have a question for Jeff. I'm wondering what you could share with us about, like, what is your most wild dream for the future of Sinai and Synapses when you think ahead, mm-hmm. you know, 10, 20 years? Like, what is there anything you think that you like wish could happen, but mm-hmm. we're just not quite there yet?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. It's interesting. I have trouble thinking that far in advance because everything that we do through Sinai and Synapses is designed to be grassroots and local and relationship based. And I want to see what could happen. 10 or 20 years from now, you know, if we've got, however, you know, 200 or 300 fellows who have gone through that, you know, one thing that was incredibly gratifying to me, I was almost crying with this. In May, we had this alumni meeting and we decided we were going to do a big public event at the 92nd Street Y. And we had all the, you know, tons of previous fellows who were there, and it was a packed house. And mm-hmm. And
it was an amazing experience. Sorry to interrupt, but oh my gosh, it was such an incredible moment.
It was one of my favorite. It was probably one of my favorite moments. Thinking, not to toot my own horn a little bit, but I was thinking, you know, this was a germ of an idea in 2011 that became an experiment in 2013, and it has enough legs that all these people have come back from two or four years previously, and spent multiple days in New York City thinking about these kinds of questions, and then opened this up at the 92nd Street Y, and people were so engaged and so thoughtful, and so one thing that we're hoping is with this project, we have another project called Scientists and Synagogues that we're hoping maybe a parallel of this in this way. We'll see where things are. Waiting on some funding on that. But what we're hoping with at least Scientists and Synagogues, God willing, may the funding continue and grow, and maybe a parallel of this of the fellowship, of what would it look like if we had a two-day conference in New York City with a breakout, you know, with all the previous fellows presenting on different topics that they're working on. And what would it look like to bring in somebody like, as a keynote speaker, like a Brian Greene? You know, bring in somebody who is grappling with some of these big science and religion questions. Can we bring in a couple of Nobel laureates? Can we bring in the different Templeton Prize winners? And to be able to both have a massive public event that gets lots of press and people are saying, wow, this is, I never thought of it like this before, but also to have people in North Carolina and Texas and Kansas and Pennsylvania and Oklahoma, you know, being able to talk in their communities and to be able to say, I can talk about this in a different kind of way. I'm equipped to be able to think about these kinds of questions. you know, one thing that is mildly concerning to us is that we've got tremendous diversity. The one thing that we do not have a lot of diversity on is political diversity. We have a lot of people who either were conservatives or Republicans, or have friends who were conservatives or Republicans, or live in an area with a lot of conservatives and Republicans, but do not currently identify that way. And so we have a lot of conversations with who are conservative adjacent, or at least respectful of conservatives, but we have not had a Trump supporter in our fellowship. You know, we haven't somebody who would identify as a Republican. And I think that's an important voice in there that would potentially be challenging to have a safety in there. But I also think that's an important voice that's missing in our fellowship. And at the same time, I think that we do need to be able to equip more people to have reasoned conversations without it becoming a screed. And that may be a win enough as well.
You know, one of the things that I think there was a overwhelming consensus on after our first meeting was that each and every one of us in our own context felt like we were the only ones who cared about this or had questions about this, and we just felt alone until we got into that room. And I think when we had that alumni event and then culminating in that event at the Y, which, by the way, is when Jeff introduced Adam as an intellectual heavyweight, and we give him a hard time about that ever since. It made it into last week's episode, and I realized that nobody else would get that joke.
It was awesome.
So this is me explaining an inside joke from last week's episode. But anyway, and I think that is a part of the power of what you're doing through the fellowship and through your other work, uniting people who feel like they are the only ones where they are, and bringing them together a couple of times a year, and then through social media and through the internet, the wonders of the internet, helping people to feel like they have a community of people. And that's one of the reasons why we were really excited to do this podcast too, is we want to reach out, bring this out of the little siloed conversations, mm-hmm. and bring it out to people who also feel like they're the only ones. And let people know that you are not the only ones, and this is a conversation that we can all be having together. So I will just echo that and just say that was an amazing event and a really, really great week in New York. And I'll tell you, as somebody who grew up in Central Jersey, I have always been more of a Philly guy. Mm-hmm. And I have had probably deep-seated, not at all reasonable distrust for New York City, probably just because of, you know, the tribal part of my brain. And that's where the Mets and Yankees live. But I'll tell you, those 4 days I spent in New York really changed my perception of the whole city because of you people are there, and It was just so wonderful.
And you, I know you would get up at, you know, 4:30 in the morning to take your bus to be able to come day of.
Oh, no, 4:30 was when my bus left.
Oh, man.
It was, yeah. There's not a whole lot of good transportation from Reading to New York anymore. We used to just have the Reading Railroad, and now that only exists on Monopoly boards.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So, while, you know, while of course echoing what others have said, except for Zach, because I also spent a few days in New York and I did not come away with that feeling. I am a small town person, and there's nothing that could make New York appealing.
I loved it.
In those ways, except for the people, which is really just in one room. So it wasn't all right. New York. No disrespect to the city or people who love the city.
Oh, we're going
to
lose all kinds of listeners now.
We're all different. Diversity comes in many different forms. But Jeff, I wanted to ask you almost an opposite question of what Kendra asked, which is, what are you challenged by, or what are you afraid of for the fellowship?
Funding is always the one that's a question, but we just secured a little bit more, which we're excited about. So, but that's always, you know, that's always the question, because I think that, you know, first of all, it takes time for me and Rachel Pincus, who's our incredible program administrator. But the other piece too is we really love getting doctoral students, and doctoral students, and Kendra, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess is that doctoral students don't have a huge amount of money. And I think one reason that a lot of doctoral students applied is because we were able to cover a lot of their travel. And I think doctoral students are really key, because it's getting them early in their professional trajectory. That's something that is, I think that's an important piece. But that's, you know, that's in the Hebrew Yiddish word, that's the tachlis piece. That's the practical piece.
Exactly.
I think, you know, one thing that's always a risk is the group dynamic, because it's, you know, 12 to 15, to, you know, really smart, really accomplished people who we take a risk on, right? We're investing in them. And there were some people that we really wanted to accept and we couldn't last time. And so, you know, we get it through the application and through that interview, and interviewing is a particular skill that some people have. Writing an application is a particular skill, and you know, luckily we have not had any duds, but we've had some. You know, some people have been able to contribute more than others, and that's, you know, that, and that's, and just being able to understand that if they're not necessarily creating the content that we need as a deliverable, they're bringing value to the room, and they're bringing value from their perspective, right? So trying to find value there, but you know, there's always the risk that we're going to select someone who's a little bit of a jerk. You know, we may select someone who takes and doesn't contribute, and also, you know, there's this the dynamic of a group that happens, right? There's not every individual, but you know what, and I don't like being this person, but there are sometimes when I've got to say, like, okay, come towards a close. Like, you've talked for a long time. You know, if you've got, and by the way, we try intentionally to block off a tremendous amount of time. We try to be really, really respectful of everyone's time, to start on time and to end on time with the agenda, and to make sure that there's breaks. But, you know, how do you kindly say to someone who is opening up their heart, like, okay, shut up now. Like, that's, you know, like, instead of coming out off that way. And that's a balance, because sometimes a really deep conversation, a deep vulnerability, they need 6 minutes rather than three. But we've got an hour and a half, and we've got 16 people, and the person who's waiting to go, they're twiddling their thumbs, and I need to be respectful of everyone's time. And so trying to balance both the needs of each individual fellow and the needs of the group/fellowship as a whole, that's always a dance that I remember one meeting in the first group that I did not do a particularly good job on. I was a little worried that, like, the thing was going to die after this, because the fellows afterwards felt like it was relatively okay, but it was so amorphous at that point that it became a little bit tense, and I felt like I did not do a particularly good job in that meeting. And luckily, people, the relationships of those who are really dedicated, you know, have continued on. And a couple of people who haven't been able to be part of it in person still are very supportive at whatever level they're able to be supportive. Because the other thing too is, this is my full-time job. It's no one else's full-time job. And so there's something like, you got to do this. And like, if I'm on that side, like, okay, but I've got this work that I've got to do. I've got to be doing this. And like, this is not my full-time job. This is going to be lower on my priority list. And I learned to be able to say, you know, when do I need to push and say, like, this is part of an obligation that you've made. And some of it is, you know what, you can come back in at whatever level you need to, you're able to come back in. We want you as part of this. And I also understand if this is not the time or place for you to be as generative now. And so some of it's making sure that we have enough fellows so that if there are people who are not as generative, there will be other people who will pick up that slack.
So we're nearing the end. So if you could just give us your elevator speech on why people should apply to the fellowship, which as of the end of recording this episode, and definitely by the launching of this episode, will be open for applications. Why should people apply, and what goodies are you planning for this year?
Oh, boy. So people should apply if they are interested in having the kinds of conversations that they never would get to have otherwise, to feel energized and reinvigorated and to think about big questions in really exciting ways and get to meet people and become friends with people that you never would have met otherwise. What's incredible to me of, for example, the five of you who are doing this, there's such chemistry that the five of you have together that never would have existed out of this fellowship. And I think that it's, and as a couple of you have said, that, you know, this is something that you never would have thought or experienced otherwise. And so for some, it might be a way to be able to think about the research in a different kind of way. Some of it might be building connections and relationships they wouldn't have expected or experienced otherwise. They will get to learn from some of the most brilliant thinkers out there on some amazing, amazing work. I mean, we've lined up again the same speakers that we had last time. And so we'll learn from Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who's a NASA astrophysicist and an evangelical Christian and directs the AAAS Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. And then we'll have Stuart Feierstein, who is the former chair of the Columbia Biology Department and also wrote books called Ignorance, How It Drives Science, and Failure, Why Science is So Successful. And he'll be in conversation with Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, who's the president of CLAWL, and also wrote a book called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. And then Professor Carl Giberson, who was one of the founders of BioLogos, he launched it with Francis Collins, who's now the head of the NIH. And Carl is going to talk about the role of politics and identity in the science and religion discussion. We're still finding out who his conversation partner is going to be. So there's opportunities to learn from, in my mind, some of the most brilliant, kindest thinkers, from experts, but also learn from peers that you wouldn't get to learn from otherwise. And so if you're interested in having these kinds of connections and relationships that are going to build and last for years to come, and help get out of your silo, I strongly, strongly encourage you to apply.
That's a good elevator speech.
Yeah.
That's a New York
elevator.
I wish
I could apply again.
And the deadline, by the way, I will say the deadline is going to be Wednesday, December 4th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. So about 6 or 7 weeks open. The application is not particularly long or onerous. It's designed to make you think a little bit. But it is not, you know, a 27-page discourse on what you're thinking about. It's designed to think about a lot of questions and to help us get a sense of who you might be.
Hmm. And one of the perks of fellows is they get to come on the podcast, right?
Absolutely.
That's right.
That's a huge piece.
A huge perk. We're kind of a big deal. I don't know if you knew this.
Can't help it, you know?
Yeah.
Always good for our ego, Jeff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, and it says actually on the application says that one of the things it is both an opportunity, and we won't necessarily obligate everybody, but we were going to very strongly encourage all of our fellows, because I think the more personal the conversation can be, the better it's going to be, and that can be a challenge for academics. But being able to have it. People be as open and vulnerable as they would like to be, I think that's how the conversation changes.
Yeah. I wish we could have every one of the fellows from our group on the podcast, but logistically, having 16 hosts is just not possible. But wouldn't that be great? But it would be really wonderful to have all of the next ones just kind of one at a time.
Yep.
I'd love that.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much, Jeff, for coming out. And I say coming out, you're in your office, but for coming on
meeting
the
with
internet,
us.
Meeting with us in this particular corner of the interwebs to talk about this project that is so important to all of us. Thank you for your vision and your enthusiasm and for seeing the best in everyone. And one final plug. everyone out there who's listening who is on the fence as to whether or not this is something they want to do, I want to push you off the fence and say, yes, you should definitely do this. Yeah. Also, one more shout out to Rachel Pincus. She got one shout out earlier. She does not, she's a quiet person, not, doesn't want to be behind the microphone, but she is the heart and soul of a lot of this and makes a lot of the logistics happen so smoothly.
She absolutely does.
Hi, Rachel. I hope you listen to the podcast, Rachel. Hi.
Yeah.
Yes. Hi, Rachel.
She's been with us for maybe almost two and a half years, and she has helped us grow to whole new heights. And she has just been, she's been an incredible partner. And we've been dealing with trying to update our website. We accidentally broke the site for a few days, just came back online. So we're going to update the site after the applications are closed in December. But she's been, when the new website comes out, her fingerprints are all over that. And
oh, good.
So it's
she's brilliant.
She is
brilliant, amazing person. Okay,
all right.
We so appreciate everything.
Thank you, Jeff, and Cyanide Synapses have done.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Well, thank you to, because this has been this podcast is, first of all, it's just a joy to listen to. But this is very much the mission of what we're trying to be able to do, of trying to get people talking about and thinking about these kinds of questions in a public way and reaching more and more people. And there's a blessing in Judaism that I'll say, which is chazak chazak v'nit chazek. May you go from strength to strength, and may you strengthen one another.
This has been episode 11 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you like what you hear, do us a favor and leave us a review on iTunes and follow us on social media. It might not seem important, but it really does help people to find the show. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes and links to all our social media accounts. Next week, we're picking up where we left off, talking about public prayer, Pastafarians, petty politicians, and particularly peculiar personal pet peeves. Whew. Remember, applications for the next round of the Sinai and Synapses Fellowship are due December 4th. You can learn more about the program at sinaiandsynapses.org. And until next time, remember,
it's really easy to be encouraging and see the best in all of you, because you all are unbelievable people.